from the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. This is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations and comments featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. The Victorian English poet Rudyard Kipling looked at India and counted it as part of the white man's burden, one of Britain's new-caught, sullen peoples. But even after generations of social and scientific progress, stereotypes about India persist. According to one Indian novelist, who recently completed a fellowship at the National Humanities Center, the reasons for this are various and complex. Nayantara Sahgal is a novelist and political commentator. She's the author of 6 novels that reflect the Indian social scene since 1947, when India achieved its political independence from Great Britain. At the National Humanities Center, Nayantara Sahgal worked on a novel entitled A Man-Sized Cloud, a book set in the early part of the 20th century, against the background of growing Indian cultural self-awareness. Tara, let's begin our conversation about fiction and the writing of fiction in India today with a very general kind of proposition. Do you see yourself as having a responsibility as a creator of fiction about India, Indian themes, for instance?
I really don't think that the artist has any responsibility beyond projecting his own vision truthfully as he or she sees it. And I think it's a little dangerous when we start speaking about responsibility or commitment on the part of a writer. This debate, by the way, goes on very much in India, because in the last about 10 years, there's been a concerted effort on the part of our government to make writers, civil servants, judges, and people in other areas of life feel they have a kind of commitment, which in fact ends up as being a commitment to the government of the day, which I think is not either wise or true of an artist's role. But certainly one has a vision, and one tries to communicate that according to one's lights. And my own, I think, has been interpreted more or less within a political framework, because I do definitely have a political conviction.
Well, now you've presented me with a paradox, Tara. You say that you write from a political framework, or you write to political themes. How is it possible, therefore, not to have some sort of social responsibility? I understand what you're saying when you talk about an aesthetic kind of sense or responsibility. Do you, to put it in the crudest terms, have some sort of message? Do you have large thematic things that you worry about?
Well, yes, I do, and I think most writers do. I think most writers are writing about the same thing all their lives.
What is that?
Well, it may be whatever it is, but every writer has his broad general theme.
I see.
And I think basically that is what he's writing about. He's hanging it on different pegs. He's putting it into a different framework.
Well, tell me about yours.
Mine is freedom. And by that I mean national as well as personal, and freedom as a value. And I think that's what I've been getting at through all my novels. And I would say that I'm not writing political novels in the sense that you would perhaps say Frederick Forsyth's Day of the Jackal is a political novel. It's about de Gaulle and an attempt to assassinate him. It's about a political figure. I'm not writing a political novel in that sense. I'm writing from a political commitment.
All right, now what is that commitment? Can you describe it, for instance, in partisan terms or in terms that...
Well, I think basically it's democratic. And that may sound very commonplace to you. You live in a democracy, and that's the way it's going to be 100 years hence. That's the way it's already been for 200 years.
Well, why does that differ, for instance, from what your experience is?
From
How
India?
Does it differ? Yeah.
Well, India, you see, is partly and perhaps largely a democracy by faith. It's a country where we have striven to maintain the democracy, the republic. We established independence, which was based on parliamentary institutions and universal suffrage and respect for the individual.
And I hear a but coming here. Is that right?
Well, we were told at Independence, and experts have been telling us ever since, that this is an impossibility.
Why?
That because we do not have the conditions for democracy in India. We have a large illiterate population, we have poverty, we have regionalism, we have a multi-layered, multi-religious society. We have everything possible that could...
Well, does this make you a utopian novelist, Tara?
No, because we have made it work.
Mm-hmm.
We have... we were lucky to have 17 years of a very dedicated leadership under Nehru,
mm-hmm.
who, along with his whole generation of colleagues who were instrumental in bringing about freedom through the national struggle, had a very real commitment to democracy. So it was not utopian. It was on the ground. It was there. We were experiencing it every day. There were free and fair elections. Experts and people from abroad were coming to look into the election phenomenon.
Were these heady days for artists? Yes.
Well, they were very heady days for everybody. Uh-huh. They were even heady days for businessmen,
mm-hmm.
because we were building an industrial infrastructure from scratch almost. Which there hadn't been before.
Well, what's happened now? Let's talk about the situation that you're addressing in your books today.
Well, I think what has happened is what perhaps happens after every revolution, is that there's bound to be a decay and decline of idealism. I think it happened in America. My colleagues here at the center have said that the American Revolution was a time of great idealism, euphoria, battle for freedom and justice and so on. And then a certain disillusionment sets in the aftermath. And that's not the end of the story. There's an upswing again. Now, we haven't come into our upswing.
Uh-huh.
So I am one of those who feels that we are in a sort of morass of low morale. And it is based on the fact that there's... a situation of a high degree of corruption in the polity. The leadership is no longer one of values or one that cherishes the democratic tradition. It talks about it.
Mm-hmm.
But the kind of nurture that institutions need, especially young institutions, is not there. And I found, after I had written 3 or 4 novels, that they seemed to be reflecting the current political scene, the state of hopes and fears or disillusionment that we were at.
So this was a congruence between your personal feelings and larger social concerns that wasn't necessarily deliberate on your part.
It was wholly undeliberate.
Uh-huh.
I discovered, and I came to discover it only through talking to other people or being interviewed or something of that kind.
Well, because there is this congruence, Tara, do you find yourself being criticized by the powers that be? Do you find yourself...
I find myself being blotted out.
Uh-huh. Censored.
Criticism would mean that you are alive and well, that you are being criticized. It's very nice to be criticized. No, I don't mean censored except during the period of emergency when I and many others were censored. In a sort of personalized power structure, it is the people who are in the shadow of the benefactor,
mm-hmm.
Who flourish.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, let's come back to something specific. Mm. How do you build into your novels large social or political conceptions that don't affect the believability, the credibility of your characters?
I think that you have to be very... very clear that you are not transmitting a message, because if you're transmitting a message, then the message is writ large.
Mm-hmm.
Just as many works I see here in American fiction, which are called historical novels,
mm-hmm.
you see the huge hand of research, stamped upon them.
Right.
And it rather takes away from the book as fiction. This is, of course, a huge theme, for a seminar.
Sure.
A semester. And I think that transformation is the most important aspect of writing, because it involves the blending of the ingredients so that they're no longer themselves. It's cooking.
Uh-huh.
I mean, the same thing is experienced in cooking. You have salt, pepper, flour, vegetables, and they're separate things. But once you have put them into the pot and onto the stove, time that it takes to make it bubble and mature, mm-hmm. and blend into a casserole,
mm-hmm.
is is the time which a novelist needs.
It sounds very tasty. let me press you again to be specific. Tell me about an example of an incident or a scene, something in your fiction that that grows from your experience, that you use to address the problems that you see in contemporary India. Is it possible to do something like that?
Let me give you an abstract thing. It comes to my mind quicker than a particular episode of my own. And this is the difference between, say, a research writer and a novelist.
I see.
Now, supposing that you're on a bus and you see an old lady get on it, and she's very tired and worn out from her day, and she's holding bags of stuff, and they're weighing her down, and she's weary. There's something about her that captures your imagination. Now, if you are a research writer, if you are a scholar, you'll get down at the next stop with her and follow her to her house and make appointments with her to note down all the facts and figures that you can.
Rather statistical.
Get to know her more and more.
Mm-hmm.
And put down everything about her. If you're a novelist, the minute she gets off that bus, you never want to see her again. Because every single thing about her is going to then interfere with your vision of her.
Mm-hmm.
And you aren't going to be able to take off. And really the point where a fact becomes fiction is when you take off.
You want her, in other words, to belong to your imagination and not to the history
books. She has done her job.
Yeah.
We don't know what has created human life. I mean, that's still a mystery. You'll have the debate still going on about Darwin and Jesus Christ and the church and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
But we still don't know.
Mm-hmm.
The miracle and the mystery of that first spark. And that is the same in fiction, that you've got all the facts, and they may remain dead facts for you, but there may be the one fact that lights up your imagination in some way which you don't understand. It's something almost psychic or mysterious. And it is when you depart from that fact completely, though using it as a starting point, that fiction is made.
Tara, you said a moment ago that in India today, the government doesn't even necessarily respond to what you write by way of criticism. It simply ignores you. How, in the face of that kind of treatment, how do you address your goals as a writer? What good do you...
Well, I don't want to be noticed by the government. I don't think the government, is important. I would rather not be noticed by the government. I think people feel much happier and freer the less government there is noticing them.
Who is your audience, then?
The audience is the urban literate or educated elite, minority, I should say, because... By any standards, it's a low percentage of literacy. It's about 33%. But when you translate that into numbers, it's quite a large number of literate people when you have a population of 700 million.
Let me present you with a really rather unpleasant scenario. Let's suppose that you were simply to disappear as a political commentator and a novelist. Who would miss you? How?
Nobody.
Mm-hmm.
I think after a while no one would, because I think this happens and has happened in so many countries where many worthwhile people have slipped through a crack, as it were, and it's closed again and there it is.
This happened in India?
Well, no, because I think we were lucky enough to overthrow the dictatorship through an election in 1977, and the new government that came in undid that damage, restored the damage to the Constitution, restored civil rights, and put us back on the democratic track.
Mm-hmm.
But were this situation to go on long enough, as it has done in so many countries, after all, what happens to those writers? Either they are not heard of in their own societies, or in a desperate situation, they might leave and become expatriates. And I cannot imagine myself ever doing that, so I would just slip through the crack and disappear. So I don't think writing is enough. I think writing is only the very beginning. But I think it's very, very important. And it is much more important for... I was brought up that way myself, to feel that to whom much is given, of such a person much is also expected. And you have to give it back to your society.
Tara, tell me, where are the wellsprings? Where are the origins of your political beliefs?
My own are very simple. I think that I, because of the freedom struggle my parents took part in, am very much influenced by Mahatma Gandhi's view of nonviolence as a political instrument and as a way of life. And I am very preoccupied with nonviolence in my fiction, and sometimes you reflect it more strongly by its opposite, mm-hmm. you know, by presenting the violence that there is. And as you know, I mean, the opposite often highlights
You work by contrast.
Yes, mm-hmm. yes, very often. And my own ideas are much influenced by that. I feel that it is not past, that it is in the future, that nonviolence is yet to come, and that we, not only in India, but I mean internationally, have still to make use of this huge mm-hmm. weapon which has hardly been touched. I've always felt, as Rilke did, that a question is a very valuable thing to pose. You know, if you have the question, then at some point...
Just
some
the opening up of the issue.
Well, mm-hmm. you not only the opening up the issue, but the question itself then means that you find yourself walking one day into the answer.
From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You're listening to a conversation about modern-day India and Indian culture. My guest is Nayantara Sahgal, an Indian novelist and political commentator who recently completed a fellowship at the National Humanities Center. Nayantara Sahgal is the author of 6 novels about Indian society and politics. At the National Humanities Center, she worked on a new novel entitled A Man-Sized Cloud, which departs from the contemporary setting of her previous books to examine Indian society earlier in the 20th century, when Indian cultural self-awareness began to stir. Here is Nayantara Sahgal.
In my fiction, I think I have been very much preoccupied with, again, not as a message, because I'm opposed to messages with a capital M, but I'm interested in the Hindu culture, because that is the dominant culture of the country. I happen to be a Hindu. And obviously, what any society represents is going to come out of what they believe, the way they handle crises. Hindu culture has been, for many years, a culture with its back to the wall. We have had 600 years of Mughal rule before the British conquest. And so, it's been the dominant culture of the country, but it's not been the ruling culture. Mm-hmm. And therefore, I think this has affected the character in various ways. It has implanted a sort of courtier attitude, an ability and a desire to please so that you survive.
Vis-a-vis the British.
Vis-a-vis the ruler, uh-huh. whoever he might be. Mm-hmm. And it has had a long survival value, but mm-hmm. that does not... mean that it has been a living culture which has been able to really give a sort of point of view to its people and a reason to get up in the morning feeling confident. And what I'm interested in, and I hope that I am able to convey that through my characters, is that Hinduism has to ask itself what it means today. What does it stand for? What are the values it is willing to fight to defend? But my purpose is to infuse an injection of life into what has been a quietist, sort of quiescent sort of culture for too long.
Too passive.
Yes, which has been accepting and rather fateful. That, I don't think, is its real essence, but it has become like that. And therefore, today, people have to become active ingredients in their culture.
Is this Hindu culture that you describe and the cultural inheritance of Hinduism that you describe in your books, is it intrinsically passive? Has it been made to be passive, suppressed? What's
well, partly I think conquest results in passivity because, mm-hmm. as I said, a person or a culture that wants to survive, wants to keep out of sight and simply survive, keep going. That's not life. It's just survival. This has become to me a culture of survivors. People who have just wanted to keep going, they've stuck to their faith, they haven't wanted their rituals and their beliefs and their way of life, which is 3,000 or 4,000 years old, wiped out. And they've held on to it. And India does have an unbroken tradition of continuity, which is unique in the world. Mm-hmm. No other country has this.
How is it going to survive?
Now, it will survive because it has survived, but I'm looking for more than survival.
You want assertiveness.
I'm looking for a resurrection. Uh-huh. I'm looking for a country that will arise and say, I am, you mm-hmm. know, which will affirm itself, which will be proud of what it stands for, which will be courageous and have something really active to pass on to its children.
Well, how do the people who hold the reins of power today in India, how do they differ from that? Why would they differ from that? Are they not proud of their inheritance?
In the past, we had foreign rulers, mm-hmm. amongst them the British. And the population was a passive population that was ruled. Now, and what has come to pass in the last 10 or 12 years is that we still have the rulers and the ruled and that division between them, though they're all Indian. Because we have substituted a leadership which was very enlightened, highly democratic and dedicated for the first 17 or 18 years after independence with a leadership that is trying to institute personal and family rule and promote a dynasty. And therefore, in that process, as happened in the case of Iran, with the Shah setting up a dynasty, you do have the democratic values suffering mm-hmm. and the institutions being eroded because nobody is giving them the kind of support and nurture that they need. And it is the leadership who has to provide that support from the top so that it will be supported at all levels, locally and in the districts and so on.
Tara, what would you have general American audiences know about India? Either personal sentiments that you have,
I think that they would, they should read fiction, mm-hmm. because I think that's where you learn so much about a country. I think the first thing that one has to say is that that Indians are of all kinds. It's a society which is not a homogeneous society. It's not as though I were talking about, say, Sweden mm-hmm. or Holland. Mm-hmm. It is a huge...
Of course, the Swedes and the Dutch would instantly dispute that.
Well, but they are far more homogeneous than, uh-huh. say, America
yeah.
or the Soviet Union or India, because these are multi-religious, you know, multi-ethnic, multi-layered societies. In India, there's also the layers of advance. Some people are really living in the Middle Ages still in rural areas. Mm-hmm. Others are in the 20th century, so there's that whole distance to be covered before we become a homogeneous society. So you'd make a very dangerous statement if you said that there's this to be learnt about Indians or there mm-hmm. is that. They're extremely nonviolent people. They're extremely violent people. There are good socialists who believe in that capitalism is the devil. There are successful and entrepreneurs, highly brilliant innovators in that line, who think that the socialists are morons mm-hmm. and they want to dump them and get on with their work. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a place where ideas are in tumult mm-hmm. and everything is in the melting pot, and there's great avenues opening up for change. So the first thing I would like people to know is that we are secular, that we are modern, that we cherish scientific advance, that we are in fact the ninth industrialized country in the world, though we started from scratch with practically no industry in 1947, and that we are making a superhuman effort to grow into modern times with the weight of an incredibly ancient past behind us, which is a lot of baggage to carry. And we want to carry it, too. Mm-hmm. We want to keep the best of that. We don't want to pull our society up by the roots. We don't believe in forced methods of government. We want the democracy and we want the modernity.
Now, you use the word baggage. How do you feel the burdens of what you've just described upon your shoulders as a novelist?
Well, in the sense that one is constantly aware of the attitudes that are produced by, say, the joint family or the caste system. Mm-hmm. These are hoary institutions, which are still there today in Indian life. There's no such thing almost as what you call the nuclear family. And these produce certain attitudes of mind. The caste system, for instance, we've abolished untouchability at independence. It's a penal offense to treat anyone as an untouchable. But in areas it does still go on because custom has so far to go before it catches up with the law. Mm-hmm. And many people whom you'd think otherwise enlightened, as I think in your country, in the black-white situation,
yeah.
you will find that scratch the surface and they're not.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that they are deeply prejudiced, that they wouldn't think of perhaps socially mingling, much less marriage, you know, mm-hmm. with an outcast or what used to be called an outcast.
And do you consider yourself a feminist?
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yes, I would be extremely hurt if persons considered me anything else.
Mm-hmm. How do you transfer those concerns into your fiction?
Well, I have tried to propose solutions of a kind that other writers didn't, some didn't. Very often in Indian fiction, the theme might touch on, say, a subject like divorce, or the wife who is very ill-treated will run away from home, for instance, but she will come back. She'll see the light. She'll return to traditional values.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in my case, if she's married to a male chauvinist pig, she leaves.
And stays left.
Yeah, that's uh-huh. what's happened in my books. Now, again, I didn't arrange it that way, but that obviously came out of my consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't have a woman unless I were writing deep tragedy. And I think that even in the deepest tragedy, there has to be some light.
Mm-hmm.
Even in that, in the depths of the consciousness of the slave, there must be the hope that there's freedom, you know, and one day he'll see it. So you can't leave anybody in total blackness ever.
Tara, I remember hearing, I think, a line attributed to Flannery O'Connor, that people without hope don't write novels.
That's true. I don't think any artist is without hope.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really think any human being is without hope.
And what do you hope for India in your books?
Well, I hope that we will become a free society in the true sense. And I think that will happen if we can muddle through this period, which is very unhopeful, if we can put aside this idea of dynasty, if we can bring into power a leadership which is of shining integrity. Now, if you tell me that's hopeless, I don't think it is, because we've known it in India. And I think we could, with luck, produce such a leadership, because the people are crying out for that. So if we get onto that path in not too long a time, I think we will be able to build the society of our dreams, which can only be done through freedom and education, which is not widespread at the moment. And on that, many other things will arise.
The program is Soundings from the National Humanities Center. This is Wayne Pond. You've been listening to a discussion about contemporary India and Indian culture. My guest was Nayantara Sahgal, a novelist and political commentator who recently completed a fellowship at the National Humanities Center. Nayantara Sahgal is the author of 6 novels set in modern-day India. Her new novel, entitled A Man-Sized Cloud, examines Indian society and politics against the background of India earlier in the 20th century, during a period of growing Indian cultural self-awareness. Next week on Soundings, a discussion about culture and politics in the world of classical Greece and Rome. My guests will be 3 scholars at the National Humanities Center: Helen North of Swarthmore College, Michael Alexander of the University of Illinois, and Josiah Ober of Montana State University. Soundings would like to hear from you. Send your comments to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings is made possible by grants from the National Endowment for the Humanities.